orientating ourselves on the old parliament side. We were more on that other side. It's not going to be a long session because 32 candidates, some of them are already around. But it has not that we should also get taken through the packages we have and also ourselves as the committee to chant the way forward so that when we get into the interviews, we do not struggle. But I also want to just clear the meeting that with us we have Honorable Faku, who has replaced Honorable Mthembu due to ill health. As you know, we have also had a similar situation with regards to Honorable Van Damme, who replaced Honorable McKenzie out of ill health. And these members will then continue until we finish with the process. But it's important that you take note of that. As I said, I'm not going to waste time. I'll just check with Mr. Roma and Mr. Moore to just help you extend the package for you. And from there, we'll develop the way forward and how we are going to do this process. Can you do that? Thank you. Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members, good morning. We have prepared the file for members, which contains the notice of the meeting for the 3 days, which is today, tomorrow, and on Thursday, as well as the list of candidates, the 20 candidates that the committee has shortlisted. The program for today's interviews, members will be, another program will be program for tomorrow and Thursday will be emailed to members later today. We've got the abridged CVs of all shortlisted candidates, and we've also got the themes for the interviews. Mr. Malega will speak more on this one. We've got the candidates' presentations. Candidates will be making presentations to the committee, 10-minute presentations to the committee. So you have their presentations right at the back, and we also just added two documents for information purposes. We've prepared the copies of the ICASA Act for those members that do not have the copy. And Chairperson, I'm not sure, but I think it's also just important to indicate to members that we've had a candidate withdrawing from the process, stating that he's got other commitments. Mr. Sipotso Deity has withdrawn, and thus far, that's the one candidate that has returned formally to the committee. The Chair, Mr. Malek.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, good morning. As is the norm, we provided you with a couple of things to assist members in the interview process. And like I said, it's just themes so that members can extrapolate sense from the themes to formulate their questions. But this is also to assist the support staff in terms of organizing the interviews and getting the right kind of information for post the interviews. In total, there's about three broad themes. The first theme will be looking specifically at the legislation of governing the sector. So basically, it's about to see whether the candidate can demonstrate an understanding of the sector as a whole, including in telecoms, broadcasting and postal services. And also, if they can make some inference on the digital economy as well as the 4IR phenomenon. The second, and then of course we do provide points towards the answers that you want, so members can use that free-willingly just to sort of make it variable in terms of the kind of questions that are asked. The second part of the themes looks at the knowledge of the sector, and here we want to see whether the candidate can demonstrate an understanding of the relationship between government, the industry, and the regulator, looking specifically into the issues around South Africa and the convergence phenomenon. And then there is one that looks specifically on the regulation in South Africa and looking at the broader entities that deal with the regulation of the ICT sector. Of course, also they want the candidate to demonstrate an understanding of where the regulator sits within the context of all other regulators impacting on the sector. And lastly, which is also part of the regulatory question or theme, we want to look at the issue around the, you know, the contentious issue of the gazetted policy on the high demand spectrum, which was released recently by the minister. And other than that, there is, Honourable Chair, the presentation themes that were also afforded. There were two questions that were afforded to the candidates, so they will have to choose between the two questions. Broadly, the first one looks at the role of the ITU in conjunction with the NDP, of course, and then the second really looks at the National Integrated ICT Policy White Paper. I think all in all, Chairperson, that's about it, unless if members do have some other questions related. Lastly, I must say that we did circulate a lot of documents to support the theme, so I'm hoping that the members did receive. I know that Mr. Ngoma could not print all of them, but they are just to assist members in terms of contextualizing their questions with the themes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just to add to Mr. Madleka, Chairperson and members previously would prepare questions that instead of themes, would provide questions to members. However, it became a concern when we dealt with this, particularly the SABC, that we're imposing questions on members. Hence, we have prepared the themes, and then members will use them to formulate questions. That's why, I thought that it was important that I explain that, because then members maybe who have been in the committee previously would wonder why we have not provided the actual questions. That's
May I just check if there are clarifications that are needed? Alinda, sit down. or you want Dr. Ndlozi to be the one to sit down? What a nice event. So we just want to check if there are clarities. If there are not, we can then get to the next point. I'm sure you did hear that one of the candidates has withdrawn.
I just wanted to say today is my anniversary, so please come with me.
Okay, can we then move from Jonathan to something else? All right, can we then just make sure that we also look at the program. If you look at the program, on each candidate, we spend about 5 minutes, of which there's a 10-minute presentation by the candidate leaving us with 35. And if we can agree amongst ourselves that the next would be 5 minutes interaction by each candidate, by each member in engaging the candidate and getting also responses at the same time, so that we can, in a way, manage the time. The 5 minutes that's allocated. That's agreed? So if that is agreed, we just need to, again, just for the sake of completeness, if we have 7 members, we shouldn't be asking ourselves who's going to be asking the question at one time. Can we probably help in that regard, so that you know that you'll be the first to ask the question? But as I said, if you need clarity, it's now, or else we'll be able to start at half past. Yes, so that we also allow members after this clarity. I'm sure you would want to finalize one. two things in terms of your question, touching on sort of by half past, we convene the first candidate, if that helps you. Honorable, just.
Thank you, Chair. No, just maybe a clarity that I could get in terms of these prepared. I'm just wondering what would happen if Honorable Mukako has the same question that maybe Honorable Mulana. There's no structure of how we should ask questions. So if maybe he would ask questions about ICASA, only to find that I have the similar question to that, and the candidate has already responded to it. So it was much better if we had a structured question, so that even if one person would ask that question, then you would know that you cancel it, then you go to the next one. So I'm not sure of, because now it's not structured. Maybe it's your way of doing things.
But I'm asking Honorable Malala, and then we'll ask him to just.
Yeah.
We'll follow after Honorable Malala.
Yeah, Chair, I think I also just want to make a follow-up, because these themes, for me, they are quite broad. And on an interview, you need specific responses. I'll just give an example on legislation. The legislation may pick a number of issues, but critical to this specific interview, you might find that certain clause is very key in terms of determining the output or the response of the candidate. Now, I don't know, because we can't reinvent the wheel and go back where we are. But I thought Maleka could just elaborate a little bit on each item in terms of his assessment. If you talk legislation, which areas specifically, for instance, are critical for today's event? Don't just make us read the whole 9 legislation and then be asking questions that may not specifically be on target. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. The themes are a guide in terms of the broad issues we need to cover. Can we not be restricted to the questions, because each one of us has done research on the candidate? Can we just ask the questions that we see fit? And if someone's already asked a question you want to ask, move on. I don't think we're required to fill the full hour. For example, if we see a candidate that does not fit the requirements, we do not have to make the process long. So let's just ask the questions we need to, and if we don't have questions, then move on. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just like the Honourable Member said, the themes are merely a guide, and I think that we try to avoid, by all means, as Mr. Ngoma said, to be prescriptive in terms of the questions. So in the guide, you'll see that there's points towards the answer. And our take was that members would then extrapolate sense from the points towards the answer and ask a question related to the point that they want to raise within the context of the theme. So I think that the supporting documents should provide enough cover for members, so that it does not seem that we're asking the same questions too. Throughout. But I think it's been the norm that in the themes, the honourable members will then pick out the key issues that they are interested in to ask questions. I'm sure members who've sat through the process can also assist, but it's quite an easy process to pick out a theme or from the supporting documents ask a question, because it also guides us in terms of doing analysis as to where this area of questioning is going, or which area of theme is it following. I don't know if that answers the question, Chair.
And I think what is clearer is that it's not specifically that Honorable so-and-so would only ask questions on this thing. So whatever the question that comes through, at least you are guided by the themes, and in that way it will be easy to capture the point. That's the understanding, right? So if that's the case, as I said, the candidates may be outside the latest, if we start at 25 to. So I'm saying that was the latest, but we intend starting at half past. So in case you want to look at one or two things after this clarity.
I can allow it for the first candidate, but I can't do it on Mr. Lance.
But
can
you can
no, but for Salah,
you have only two.
Only for the first one.
I can't do it. I'm not a watch. I see another collect.
And then I
will.
I'm worried with my people. So I would rather sacrifice mine for
okay.
One.
Okay.
So what did he say he's gonna email you?
He said he was gonna email me, but I'm worried that he doesn't get the email address wrong.
No, he
won't. Because the 0601.
So he said, when he said he's gonna email it to you? When? Now?
I don't know. He just said email.
What is the purpose? You want to post them up?
No, I just need them to write my report.
Okay. So if I email you now, you'll keep it confidential.
No, I don't want to be
let's treat like that. Continue with the questions.
My mom's full time, and my mom's in the same gym. Because it's a cyclone block.
When the dissertation you want to start, in 2 years time, right?
Next
4 years.
Year. Two.
So 2 years. Mm.
Why would it be 4 years?
I know at best the master's for public administration is 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I did my master's at best. Well,
oh.
I took 3 years, but I know after my...
I know three years is like the maximum time.
It's not at all, because for us, I know that 3 years, they didn't have a policy there, so I did mine and a couple of other people did 3 years. And then after our crop, they said, look, they're going to do 2 years of coursework and then 2 years of research.
Was that a long time ago?
Yeah, 2010 I graduated, so a while back. But also I have the same degree, except mine is more on ICC policy.
But still
public administration. Mm-hmm. I wonder what institution you work for or where you're going to do it.
You know,
and the research doesn't pay much.
What is the
It doesn't pay. It depends which institution you go to.
Mm-hmm.
If you just want to be a researcher, it might pay you well. Going to an institution that deals with research output. Kind of thing, you know, like your peer, PricewaterhouseCoopers, you know, or Deloitte.
Yeah.
You see a lot of public policy. I'm telling you, I'm gonna.
No, don't give it to.
Have you always worked?
I worked at the department of communication for a certain and then for. Well, I get that too. They say I look like I'm from Cape Town, but I'm not. But yeah, I needed a change, and I kind of liked it at first.
I'm so surprised that you say that, because every person that I meet who's from those are just like, we're tired of this, how do you want to go?
Trust me, I've been there.
Oh,
like for 3 years I was in denial, but then after I brought my kids here, they love it, so I had to sort of, not that I hated Cape Town, but it was more like a longing to me.
Are you guys okay?
I was here. We're talking biograph.
Not foundation.
No, biograph. So now I'm in love. Okay, I don't see myself living in Gauteng, I guess.
In the city, so you're going to die in
Cape Town? I don't know about that. But I'm comfortable here. It's a much more dynamic area than the jungle. And I love the ocean.
Okay.
For me, this is more comfortable than I think it's true. You know when it's your home, you kind of want to outgrow it. Yeah. I don't know about you, but for me.
Do you feel it at the beach?
Yeah, I live in Parkland.
Okay, so that is good.
Yeah, it's like 10 minutes drive from the beach.
Okay.
And you, where do you live?
I am currently staying in one of these EBBs, like my family.
Oh.
It's here, very
dressed by Boca. Oh, Boca. I know Boca.
Have you been?
I hear you guys are having huge developments coming now. You're trying to build, I don't know, a mall or something.
Okay.
I read about it last week. I've been to Boca for many times.
What did you do?
I've got friends that stay up there.
Oh, really?
Some stay in the shack there, some are in
the shack.
You know that area. How come you don't know?
No,
and I know.
Yes,
it's like it's where the school is staying, man. Just up the hill.
It's not up the hill.
Yeah, it is.
It's not a shack.
What do you want to call it?
What are you talking about? It's not a shack. There are no shacks.
There's an informal type of
school
entire thing.
There is
yeah.
Like an informal type of takeaway.
Are
no,
you
I
silent.
I am. How dare you say that? There's like many informal type of settlements close to where Cubana would be.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then further up there, it is a bit ghetto, like towards
yes,
the top
up somewhere
of the
by the end.
The
yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't mean to offend. But Bukab is a nice place. And what made you choose to go stay at the Rand?
I think it was just a thing of convenience for me, because before I did my undergrad at Stellenbosch University.
Mm.
So then I've always stayed in residence and always had that aspect.
You like that residence, right?
It's more like flat and it's very independent living.
So you live alone, it's not like the communal living.
Is it communal living? Well, I stay with two other women. So,
in a flat?
In a flat.
Okay.
Yes.
But you're all students?
Yes.
Okay.
I
can
hear it.
Yeah. So, and the women you live there, are they alright? Also doing master.
Exactly.
Okay, it's not like.
So I actually never come to them. Like, there could be days when I don't even see the people.
Okay. Yeah. At least you're not staying with freshmen.
But they do, yeah. They separate the people.
Honorable members, according to the program, we'll be now calling in Dr. Charles Lewis. Presentation. and it has been communicated to yourself that the committee would expect a 10-minute presentation on the areas that you've been given and that is of your choice. So you will then introduce yourself, but as I said, get to the 10 minutes. Thereafter, it would be the members having an opportunity to interact with you. And in that interaction, each of the members have about 5 minutes, which includes your responses to the questions that the members will be asking. Once again, feel welcome. I'm sure you are ready to move. It's your time. If you can use your 10 minutes, that's all.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning. Good morning, Honorable Members. Members of the public, colleagues, comrades and friends. As you can see from the slides on the screen behind me, my name's Charlie Lewis. I was asked to introduce myself briefly, and if I were to kind of do it in one sentence, I'm a former high school teacher, former computer programmer, former trade unionist, former academic, and now working as an independent analyst and consultant, and was persuaded to put my name forward for the ICASA Council. You can obviously ask me your CV. My CV is there in front of you. You're welcome to ask me any questions about anything that's on the CV, and I will do my best to answer them. I was asked to spend about 10 minutes going through a short presentation, a choice of two topics. It's a bit unusual for me because normally I'm on the other side of the desk setting the topics, not the one picking the topics to answer. And of course, in 10 minutes, they're quite comprehensive and complex topics. It's difficult to squeeze in the information in 10 minutes or so, but I will try, and please do feel free to ask any questions. So I took the topic looking at institutional approaches to regulation. And starting off and looking back at the origins of where ICASA as an entity, as an institutional model derives from, ICASA, as the name tells you, is an independent regulatory authority. It's a public interest body acting in the interests of the public at large, and that includes from the little gogo in a remote rural village in KwaZulu-Natal right up to the biggest captain of industry sitting somewhere in Johannesburg or Sandton. So it's a public interest body. It's a converged regulator, as we all know, which means that it deals with telecommunications, which is my particular area of interest, as well as broadcasting, which is another area of interest of mine, and also covers postal services. And it's a collegial regulatory commission, which means it's a commission made up of colleagues, people working together as a collective to regulate and manage the sector in the public interest in South Africa. So the question that I was asked to look at was where the model comes from. And it's a model that has its roots in the movement to what was sometimes known as telecoms reform or telecom reform, which began in the 1980s. And it began as a consequence of a number of pressures from business who were looking for things like leased lines, cheaper communications, and things haven't changed that much since then. There were pressures driven by technological change, the move towards digital basis for communications, the increasing role of ICT, information and communications technologies, in the economy and in driving economic growth, and that too hasn't changed. All the talk about the 4IR comes out of the same set of issues. It was also part of the increasing phenomenon of globalization, the greater global integration of economies, and was driven by pressures which originated from people like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, which I put here under the general banner of neoliberalism. In other words, a change in the way in which the sector would be governed. So those were the pressures driving ICT sector reform. Around that, there were a number of global institutions that were pushing and driving the agendas behind that and developing what they would see as best practices for sector regulation. They include the International Telecommunication Union, and in a slightly different scale, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the European Union, the World Bank had a role to play, and the IMF to a somewhat lesser extent. A lot of this kind of coalesced around the formation of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in 1995, which grew out of the General Agreement and Trade and Services negotiations of the Uruguay Round, and was put in place in 1997, an agreement on basic telecommunications, to which South Africa was a signatory, and in terms of which South Africa made a number of commitments around the changes that would take place in its sector. And a regulatory reference paper was adopted at the same time, containing some six principles, some debates as to whether it's still relevant today. The three main pillars behind that model are kind of three injunctions to governments, policymakers, etc. Thou shalt privatize thy state-owned incumbent. Telkom in those days sounds a little bit like the echoes of the SAA today. Thou shalt liberalize thy sector by introducing competition into the sector, licensing additional operators, and that's where initially MTN and Vodacom came from in the context of a fairly bun fight at the time, and thou shalt regulate the sector through an independent regulatory authority, which is where CASA comes from. Now, the word independence is obviously a key issue, and there's a lot of debate around that. I still like the phrase or the term that's used by Bill Melody, is that a regulator, an independent regulator, is one who is empowered, given the mandate, to implement policy which comes from government in particular and from the minister without undue interference, without people telling, micromanaging the regulator. And that could be interference from politicians. It could also be interference from operators, people in the sector. And that, if you're able to avoid those things, you avoid what is known as regulatory capture, which sounds like a bit of a Wild West term, but it means that the regulator ends up doing the bidding of entities outside the regulator rather than acting in the broad public interest. Three key factors work to make that happen. One is structural autonomy of the regulator, and we have that in place. The process that we are running through at the moment is a South African demonstration of that structural autonomy. We have decision-making authority. So the regulator is empowered in South Africa, and many jurisdictions this is not the case, is empowered to issue regulations and draft regulations, and they do so all the time, as the Government Gazette bears witness to. And thirdly, the question of financial self-sufficiency, ensuring that the regulator has sufficient financial resources to do its work. So that model comes from the international best practice, good practice. How does it fit into the South African context? And if I look back since the RDP, those of you might remember that document in 1994, two main issues have dominated sector policy ever since then. One is the question of universal, or providing universal affordable access for everyone in South Africa, citizens and non-citizens, to ICT infrastructure, services and content. And that was a particularly important one in the South African context, given the history that preceded the first democratic election in 1994. Secondly, the RDP recognizes that ICT, information and communications technologies, are a key enabler of economic growth. They underpin the economy and they enable and drive the economy and of social development. through issues like health, education, welfare, etc. Some of those, and the brief I was given skipped quite a lot of the documents, but there was mention made of the National Development Plan, which came out in 2011 and which I believe is currently in the process of being revised. I'm not party to that process. But the National Development Plan sees ICTs as a key pillar to develop an information society for the people in South Africa and a knowledge economy where ICT empowers and drives economic growth. There was also a report produced by the ICT Policy Review Panel in 2015, of which I was fortunate to be a member, which had a section looking at ICASA inter alia, regulatory or institutional arrangements was the section, and stressed two issues once again: the regulatory independence of the authority as key to success in the sector, but secondly, that the regulator is accountable to the public at large, to the people of South Africa, through the representatives elected in the Parliament, through the Portfolio Committee, but obviously through the Parliament as a whole. There were two recommendations that came out of that panel report which suggested changing, and they're not obviously subject of legislation yet, suggesting changing the council to more of a King III at the time style board and looking at some kind of hybrid funding model for ICASA. Out of that policy review report, there was an integrated ICT policy white paper that came out in 2016, integrated, although unfortunately because the ministry had been split, the broadcasting section was left out of that or was not part of that. Thankfully, you're all back together again. And I just thought I ought to mention that we have a draft report from the Presidential Fourth Industrial Revolution Commission, which is sitting on the desk of the President and hopefully will see the light of day in the coming year. Now, all of those issues and factors and many others obviously influence and drive the work of ICASA as the regulator. So what does that lead us to when we think about the imperatives for ICASA in the coming year in particular, but also in general? Firstly, it's important to recognize for the council.
My apologies.
Please.
Jefferson, you're checking the time.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
I'm very close to being finished, Honorable Member. Okay. The work that ICASA does has to be rooted and anchored in the law. ICASA cannot do anything that's not specified in the ICASA Act or in the ECA, and if it does, it can obviously lead itself open to litigation. And of course, that stretches further back to the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act and the Constitution as well. Secondly, ICASA's actions, activities, and interventions are informed by considered analysis of policy, either through documents like the Integrated ICT White Paper, but certainly also in addition through ministerial policy directions of the kind that recently were issued. ICASA functions as a collegial commission. In other words, they work as a collective, drawing together the wisdom of the members on the council, looking at the evidence to arrive at carefully considered decisions, and that phrase considers in the Act itself. It's important for ICASA to balance independence with agility and responsiveness. It's a rapidly changing sector, and they will need to be able to respond rapidly and quickly to changes in the sector. The ITU talks about fourth generation regulation and transparency and accountability through Parliament to the people of the Republic and transparency to the public as a whole. Very quickly, last point, a couple of key challenges that lie ahead for ICASA in the coming year. Firstly, they're in the process of this. They need to ensure that the auction of high-demand spectrum is successful, that there are good bidders, that there are reasonable prices raised without driving operators out of business and without passing on too high prices to consumers. Secondly, they need to license the WOAN, and these two are very closely linked to each other in a way that gives us an entity that's viable, effective, and can make a difference in the market, and that does not disappear like the U-cells into the mists of history. Thirdly, they're in the process of doing a Chapter 10 inquiry on the broadband market, which they need to complete. Fourthly, there's a lot of work that comes out of the report of the Competition Commission around the data service market pricing sets of issues, and they would need to be cooperating with the Commission to make sure that those findings are carried through in a way that benefits the public as a whole, benefits the market, and keeps the operators in business at the same time. And then finally, they need to respond to the technologies and challenges of the so-called fourth industrial revolution. 5G is already around and being offered, and people are already talking about 6G. So there's a lot of challenges coming forward in the future that ICASA needs to look at. My apologies, Honorable Chair, if I overran the 10 minutes, but there you are. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. For the presentation, I will now call upon members to engage with the candidates. I will start with Honorable Kubega.
Thank you, Chair, very much. And also let me acknowledge the presentation that the candidate has been presented in front of us. And also let me say morning to you. As we know now that our country, we are having a passion actually on the issue of the fourth industrial revolution. And I'm not sure, or are we behind actually? So in your view, what are the key pillars which must be in place in order for South Africa to exploit opportunities of the 4IR? You can just list for me, can be 2 to 3, 5 pillars. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think one of the first things that one needs to recognize or think about in relation to the fourth industrial revolution is it tends to be very much of a catchphrase and a bandwagon. It's often being thrown around and bandied about, and everyone, it's almost impossible to do anything without sticking the fourth industrial revolution, the 4IR, etc., into whatever one is doing. And I think it's important for us in South Africa to avoid being uncritically swept along by that bandwagon. Okay, that's not to say that the technologies and the technological changes, things like the Internet of Things, robotics, artificial intelligence, all of those things, they are real. And they are changing the world of work, they're changing society, they're changing the way in which the economy works. Okay? So it's a very real phenomenon, but in my view what we need to do is be able to engage with the issues, the technologies from the fourth industrial revolution in a way that benefits us in South Africa. We can't simply adopt solutions from abroad because they come from abroad. I think the important thing is to interrogate which of those technologies can assist to strengthen our economy, to improve the lives and the livelihoods of our people, and what can we do to strengthen and stimulate those kind of things. Other countries have done work in that area. For example, Australia has done some work where they've picked up some of the technology and said, we want to emphasize this one and this one and that one. I can't remember which ones in particular. But I think it's very important to interact with, interrogate, and engage with the technologies and with the issues and develop applications that benefit the country, the economy, and its people.
Chair, I think I can also come to on the issue of the national integrated policy, as he was trying to explain of a white paper, Chair. The white paper advocates for the expropriation of spectra. When the license expires, this has been dropped. And also in the latest policy directive, what do you think was the problematic with expropriation of spectra?
Thank you. Yes, I did get the question. Okay. Look, it's a difficult issue. Spectrum is a public good. It's a public resource. It belongs to the people of the Republic as a whole, and it needs to be assigned to operators, from broadcasters, ISPs, telecoms operators, to be able to be used in a way that benefits the sector, helps develop and grow the technologies, and helps provide benefits for the people. I think why the question of expropriation of spectrum was dropped partly was obviously there would be a very strong pushback from the operators, particularly the mobile operators, particularly those that are sitting in some juicy pieces of spectrum. I'm not going to mention names, but there are some of them sitting in nice juicy little pieces of spectrum, and there would be a particular pushback from them to resist that. I think the CSIR analysis looking at how much spectrum was required for the WOAN suggested that there actually is more than enough to go around. And as you'll see from the paper that was issued, the process that's underway by ICASA, there's a fair chunk of spectrum available for the WOAN, and there is plenty of spectrum available for the other operators in the various bands that are open for auction. So I think the way forward that has been defined by the minister in the policy direction, and that has been picked up by ICASA, and they were very quick to pick it up and respond, and that kudos to them for that, actually offers us a good way forward, and hopefully we will see a successful auction allocation of high demand spectrum during the course of this year.
Thank you, Honorable Kopeka. Honorable Fabi.
Thank you, Dr. Lewis. Thank you for your presentation. It was indeed informative. One can say that you have a lot of experience in the sector. One of my questions will be, can you give me your understanding of how the ICT in SA are linked to the country's political economy and a central to transformation of the country? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. ICT and communications, IT, that whole cluster of technologies are very central to economic development. So they underpin business. Computers are everywhere. They underpin manufacturing, automated processes, robots, etc., are everywhere. They underpin city development. Increasing numbers of traffic lights have Internet of Things, cell phone devices in them that can communicate back to traffic control centers. And there are many, many examples that one could cite. So the technologies and the cluster of technologies are very central to economic development. But they're also very important for the lives and livelihoods of our people. I mean, when South Africa became independent or achieved a democracy in 1994, there was an enormous digital divide in the country. Cell phones, well, in those days it was mainly fixed line phones, were heavily concentrated in urban areas and in the hands of a particular group of people in the country. And that necessitated a very strong set of interventions over the years to try and redress that balance, to make sure that there was one of these in every household and hopefully in any pocket in the country. And the mobile development, the mobile sector is in one instance as one of the key success stories. You know, we've moved from something like 15% or 20% tele-density to, I think in the last thing I saw from the Stats SA, something like 86% of households now have at least one cell phone in them. Something like 50% of households have at least somebody who has used the internet in some form or another, probably largely on one of these devices. We're in the process of a digital migration, so the range of services to enrich the lives of citizens, provide cultural enrichment, and to stimulate economic growth and development has grown substantially over the 20-odd years of our democracy.
Thank you, sir. My last question will be, I see that you are talking a part of your presentation here raising the independent information. So you are mentioning the three things that can empower the regulator. One thing that I'm more interested in is the financial self-sufficiency. So can you maybe explain to us, if you can be given an opportunity to serve in the council, what would you do different so that you make sure that as a council you have financial self-sufficiency?
1 minute on that.
Okay. Honourable Chair, difficult question that one, because I know that there has been some clashes between the Minister and the Council fairly recently over exactly that particular issue, you know, the financial accountability, who the financial statements go to and how they go and how they are transmitted. You know, the reason why financial self-sufficiency is listed as one of the key reasons or the kind of key enablers of regulatory independence is if you want to stop an entity functioning, you cut off its money, and then the entity is unable to function. So financial self-sufficiency is important so that ICASA is sufficiently resourced to be able to carry out the work that it needs to do. That means research, it means drafting of regulations, which requires legal expertise, and there's licensing, there's a whole range of issues and areas that ICASA needs to work in. So it needs sufficient financial resources to be able to do that. I would hope that in that kind of contretemps impasse between the Minister and the Council, that there would have been some offline discussions. Yes, ICASA accounts to the people of South Africa through this portfolio committee. I think that's critical. But the Minister has a very important role to play, and there needs to be ongoing interaction between the Council, the Minister, and the Portfolio Committee. We're all actually in the same boat. We just maybe sit at different oars, at different places in the boat. We know what we need to do to benefit the sector, to benefit the economy, to benefit the people. We need to find ways of working together. So to some extent I'm dodging your question, but I'm hoping saner heads, careful dialogue will prevail and make sure that amicable solutions that preserve ICASA's independence, preserve its accountability, and
thank
give
you,
it sufficient financial resources will prevail. Thank you.
Honorable Malala Omachose, number three.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Dr. Charles. Thank you for the presentation. It was very informative. My question would be, what is your understanding and knowledge of the legislative prescripts governing the ICT sector, especially in the new era of convergence?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Well, the piece of legislation that currently governs the sector is a converged piece of legislation. It grew out of a process. Some of us will remember in around about the year 2000 when Andile Ngcaba was the DG of the department. A process was run that led to the Electronic Communications Act, which is largely a converged piece of legislation. So it's a converged piece of legislation that governs the sector. And it governs, it gives, sets, it casts its mandate out in a number of particular areas. The other key piece of legislation from an ICASA's point of view is the ICASA Act itself, which governs exactly what ICASA does, its roles, its functions, its responsibilities, its structures, how it's governed, who it reports to, etc., etc. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't verbatim quote from the various sections of the Act, but on my own laptop they live there, and they are things that one needs to refer to. And that's what I meant when I said earlier about being anchored in the legislation. ICASA is a creature of statute through the ICASA Act, and its mandate is created by the Electronic Communications Act, in particular the other pieces of legislation as well. And obviously the work of the Council needs to be in accordance with those particular pieces of legislation. I don't know whether that answers your question.
To follow that up, Honorable Majors?
Thank you, Chair. But my follow-up would be maybe similar to what Honorable Faku asked, but on a different term. I would want to... you know that there are different entities within the ministry, and ICASA is one of them. And there are instances where there's a duplication and overlaps of responsibilities and roles. I would want to know what would be your... What expertise would you bring on board if you were to be appointed as one of the board members, so that you bring a coordinated way of no duplication and overlaps of all the roles within the entity?
Honourable Chair, a lot of that kind of interaction between other regulators, the question of co-jurisdiction in particular with the Competition Commission, but also with the Consumer Commission, are actually set out in the Acts. I think there was an amendment in 2014 which required ICASA to enter into memorandums of agreement or memorandums of understanding between the various regulatory entities. And I'm very pleased to see that recently the MOA with the Commission was updated. It was originally signed in 2002 and it was long in need of updating, was recently updated. And I think I'm seeing from the outside a lot of collaboration and cooperation between the two entities. They work somewhat differently because the Competition Commission is typically an ex post entity. In other words, it deals with problems after they have arisen. A lot of ICASA's work is about structuring the sector, regulating the sector ex ante, in advance, setting the rules, setting the framework, setting the groundwork, so that issues like licensing, interconnection, etc., etc., happen and play out properly. Your last or your second part of the question is what would I think that I would be able to bring to the Council. I've been working in the sector now, if you go back to my COSATU days, for some 20 or so years, back in about 1996, which is when I joined COSATU at the time. I've worked in policy and policy in that particular arena. So I'd like to think that I have a very broad range of expertise in terms of research, or based on research, based on training, in a whole range of areas, from telecoms, which is my particular area of interest and expertise, through the internet, through broadcasting issues, across the board. So I think I have a fairly broad spectrum of knowledge, and I would want to be able to bring that to the Council and to assist the Council to see issues in an integrated whole. You know, they talk about the waterbed effect. If you do something over here, it may produce a counter effect over there. We're seeing that in relation to the broadcasting digital migration, where some of the spectrum that's on offer is currently occupied by existing terrestrial broadcasters or terrestrial analog broadcasters. So issues are often very complexly interdependent, and so that broad range of expertise, I think, is necessary to understand those issues. Thank you.
Honorable Mlala.
Thanks, Chair. Good morning, Prof. Charles Lewis. I want to first go back to the question you avoided, because I want a very clear response from you on your views. Remember, you must be free to express your views. It does not mean when you are in the interviews, you're supposed to be aligned to the views of. You must be independent and give us your views. You spoke about the industry, of course, is partly privatized. There's private operators, it's liberalized, and it's also regulated by gas. But what is the burning issue in between the three? It's how do we balance that, especially around the funding, how financially sufficient, sustainable is the structure. Now, when you responded to the question, you did not indicate how you balance the influence of the private sector on the regulator vis-a-vis the influence of government. You only spoke about the interference of possibly of government, but you did not indicate the other influential. And from where I'm sitting, I think you need to elaborate on this financial self-sufficient. What model would you prefer so that that model possibly can bring about the independence you spoke about? Maybe if you can elaborate more in responding to the initial question. I'll come back to the second question.
Chair, thank you. There are a range of models in terms of which regulators have been funded. There's the model that we use here, where ICASA gets its funding from an appropriation, which goes through the budget vote, and that goes to ICASA. That's one particular model. There are models elsewhere in the region. Namibia is an example for it, where there's a regulatory levy imposed upon licensees, and that goes into the regulator and allows the regulator to be funded. There are also cases where the regulator gets funding from the spectrum license fees or auction fees, etc. So there are a range of potential models. I'm not aware of, but I obviously haven't sat inside the regulator, of a particular case where somebody has tried to influence the decision-making of the regulator by choking funds. There's obviously some tension because, as we know, and we're going to hear a lot more about that tomorrow, South Africa's fiscal resources are constrained. So ICASA is not in a position where they have unlimited access to funds. In terms of a model, we as an ICT policy review panel recommended a hybrid model. In other words, where some money came through the budget vote, some money came through other sources. We didn't, I think, look at as a regulatory levy. I'm not sure that that's a very workable model. But some revenue from licensing and some revenue from spectrum. The reason why it's important that the regulator has financial resources is you don't want a situation where there's a standoff between the regulator, let's say, and one or more of the operators, and the regulator is forced to back down because it's unable to fund the litigation that is required for it to act in the public interest. So the regulator does need a certain degree of financial reserve in order to carry out its work, in order not to be forced into a corner by one or other of the operators. So I don't know whether that's a more clear and stronger answer to your question.
Honourable Mlala, only a minute you have.
Only a minute. Yeah, maybe the last part, I wanted to come back. Unfortunately, you took time to explain. But the other issue that I wanted to follow up on is on the Competition Commission report versus what ICASA is supposed to be regulating, the contradictions thereof, because I think there are contradictions in terms of both the report of the Competition Commission and what ICASA commissioned. And I need your views on those. Your partner.
Chair, thank you. I personally think the Competition Commission's final report was an excellent report. I obviously couldn't read all of it because a lot of it is redacted, but I think it's an excellent report, and I think they proposed a number of very interesting interventions that will have the effect of lowering prices in the data services market. They're not going to be easy to implement, and some of them clearly require cooperation and collaboration with ICASA, but they work differently. I mean, the Commission, the Competition Commission, takes its mandate from the Competition Act and acts in accordance with that. ICASA, before it does those kind of things, has to do a Chapter 10 inquiry. So it has to look at a market, and it's got a draft paper out on that, define the market, define the level of competition, decide or determine that there is not sufficient competition in that sector, and then intervene in a pro-competitive way, which may involve pricing. It could involve some of the recommendations of the Competition Commission as well. But I personally think the Competition Commission's report was a very interesting one. How are we going to implement some of those things like lifeline data? Interesting move, but costly for the operators. But it has its roots in issues like lifeline water, which every household in South Africa has access to where there's water. So it's doable and it's potentially fundable. The question is how you reach an agreement to implement a measure like that, as just one example.
Thank you. Honorable Ndlozi.
Thanks, Jefferson. Thanks, Dr. Lewis. I wanted to achieve you on what I think is a wrong philosophical approach to the reduction of cost to communicate in the South African market. Because the underlying assumption is competition will drive prices down. Competition in a US market at the moment, that's not the case. Prices of communication are actually exorbitantly high, despite the fact that there is huge competition. And then in the European market, it's the opposite. Now, in South Africa, there is no industry of the big industries that has more than four players that are powerful. So we are ran largely by, you could say, oligopolies. In this case, 75% of this ICT sector is owned by just two players. So in the issuing out of spectrum and the underlying assumption that competition might cause, isn't that a wrong approach? And if you agree, how do you, through ICASA, actually assume once and for all that there's no competition that is coming anytime soon? If that is the case, how do you drive prices down?
Chairperson, driving prices down, and that's prices for consumers, it's prices for industry as well, is obviously a complex set of issues. The market paradigm within which we sit as an economy at the moment is a competitive market paradigm. It's a liberalized market paradigm. And in that particular environment, I think it's important that the measures that are taken in place are measures that allow fair competition. All right, and there's an important question or thing around the word fair competition, because everybody who's a big player wants a monopoly. It's the little guys trying to get into the market that are looking for ways. So through things like the spectrum auction, and I hope I'm kind of getting to the nub of your question, the conditions that will be attached to that spectrum auction should have the potential, A, of dealing with the duopoly. You're correct to say we're in the mobile market, it's largely a duopolistic market. In some markets, other markets, we have a near monopoly, but in this market, it's largely a duopolistic market. And the intervention of the WOAN, which initially I was very skeptical of, but I think may, in the way in which it's playing itself out now under the ECA, may actually produce something very interesting. If ICASA is able to regulate properly, I think there's a problem there around the offtake requirements and how you get those kind of things to happen. But that could potentially create an operator that may facilitate or diminish the power of the duopoly and provide access and services to people in rural areas and poor communities in particular. So a lot's going to depend upon the conditions that are attached to the licenses that people are bidding for. It's not about the highest prices. It's about a licensing arrangement that gives current players sufficient spectrum to deliver services, but encourages new entrants, startups, innovation.
That's fine.
Thank you.
You have spoken largely about the ICT sector, so let's go to the broadcasting sector. Many people say we must forget about digital migration. I think ICASA in the history of broadcasting in this country has been absolutely useless because it has allowed the domination, just like in the ICT, these both industries are post largely 1994 industries. So through things like mass carrier regulations, not allowing the SABC to also compete in the direct-to-home space, what would be your view of the direction in relation to broadcasting since DTT? I think it's fair to consider that we have lost that one. What do you think should be the policy intervention that the broadcasting sector must take, which no longer takes DTT into consideration?
Thank you, Chair. I mean, there's two issues there. One of them is the broadcasting digital migration. And I have a particular strong view on the broadcasting digital migration. I think the boat has sailed. I think we've missed the boat. Streaming audio, streaming video is where the market is going. MultiChoice is moving there, SABC is moving there, Netflix, Showmax, they're all in that particular market. And I'm very concerned that moving ahead with the broadcasting digital migration as it currently stands runs the risk of creating a new television apartheid where rich households in affluent suburbs are consuming full bouquet satellite television and paying a fair amount of money for that, and the poor in townships, etc., consuming basic television services on the digital terrestrial platform. There are possible options forward. One of the roles that I play is I work for an organization, or I'm a member of an organization called the Support Public Broadcasting Coalition, which looks at these sets of issues. One of the ways forward, one would be to go completely satellite and spend the set-top box money on satellite decoders for everybody. There's another hybrid model which would see terrestrial television in the urban areas where the audience size is...
I don't have enough time. My last question is... the last question, Chairperson. I want a reaction. So this industry is dominated by old white men. You are an old white man. I realize there are some credentials of having actually been on progressive politics, but what's your reaction to that? Why should we recommend another old white man to go and regulate other old white men in the sector? Thank you.
Chairperson. you can speak.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I don't think of myself as old. I don't think of myself as white. I think of myself as a South African. Yes, in the objective demographics of the country, one is classified as an old white man. I like to think that I've always been progressive. When I was a teacher, I taught in schools in Bontheville and in Lansdowne in Cape Town. When I was in Zimbabwe, I was teaching, but I also worked with the South African Communist Party at the time, came back to South Africa, joined the trade union movement. Much of my passion in the sector is around issues like universal access and service, which was the topic of my PhD. So one is kind of older, sadder, perhaps somewhat disillusioned. I mean, in 1994 we thought, wow, you know, we're going to storm the citadels of power and change everything tomorrow. And we've recognized it's a longer and much more complex role. I would like to think that despite my pigmentation, despite my privileged background and my origins, I still have, or one still has, a role to play in assisting to change the sector for the benefit of our people. And when I talk about our people, I talk about 59 million. I don't speak on behalf of any one particular community. I speak on behalf of South African citizens and people living and working in the country who may not be citizens as well. So I would like to think that I have a contribution to make, and certainly if I am appointed, I will do my best to work in that direction.
Honourable
Chair, I don't have a question. I'd just like to say that I've listened to Dr. Lewis. I think he has the knowledge and expertise required in the industry. And I wanted to also like to see someone with a bit of grit, someone who can stand up for themselves, someone who won't be bamboozled into making certain decisions. So I think I've seen what I needed to see. Thanks, Chair. I've heard what I needed to hear.
Can I take a follow-up? What was given you, enough time, Ilatsko? I understand you may want to come back to the question to try and get Van Damme's time. But let's not do that so that we proceed. Dr. Lewis, I think having listened to you, please, we are still continuing. Having listened to you, there's a point raised by Honorable Dr. Ndlozi. I just want to confirm if I've heard you well. You can have privatization, liberalization, regulation in it. But if you can share with the committee, I'm saying not looking at the go-along, but your views. Is the sector in the country, especially the telco side, have we done enough studies to determine the size of the sector and that this sector indeed will be amenable to increasing the number of participants? I'm just saying, based on the experience of how that privatization has worked, and that you also have others that collapse in the process, even those that have been brought in, which therefore begs the question on the economics of it, whether the sector in the country as it stands allows us to go that route, so that we also know, if you were to be in ICASA, what would you think of in regulatory terms to ensure that the sector succeeds, more than just saying there is competition, when you do know that actually, as you make the add-ons, others collapse in the process, and they have to piggyback on those that have been there, and which is not really transformation of the industry. Your view on that.
Thank you, Chair. My position has shifted over the years. I mean, there was a time, I think it was in the year 2000, when I was leading the COSATU delegation at the Convergence Colloquium, and we stood up and we said, we're not signing the memorandum. And Dilek Baba ran around, and we agreed a wording which spoke about managed liberalization. So there was certainly a time when I was very strongly opposed to some of those kind of things. Over time, I don't know whether it's kind of age, maturity, wisdom, less of the fire in the belly, one comes to an understanding or a sense of, and as I said earlier, we live in a environment where competitive markets are what are expected to work. As a regulator, we need to make them work, and that means dealing with the dominant operators in the sector. You speak about the mobile sector, while we talk about a duopoly, is that two of the providers, I think, account for something like 75% of the subscriptions. They dominate that market. And so it's very important as regulators, as policymakers, to intervene to lessen that degree of dominance. And it's really the question of the abuse of dominance that we need to guard against. You can't blame dominant operators, large players, for wanting to maximize their gains, because they're answerable to shareholders. They have a share price. They have bottom lines. They have dividends they have to deal with. We need to make sure that they're still able to make those dividends, but that the market functions effectively for the benefit of the consumers, for the benefit of the industry, for the benefit of the people. And so, yes, there needs to be strong regulatory intervention to deal with dominance in the marketplace. And that would include in the broadcasting marketplace. Honorable Ndlozi cut me off before I got to that part of it. But yes, there needs to be intervention where it's necessary, where it's demonstrably important to do so.
That, in a way, because I just wanted to get that in clarity, but I'm sure you would still, like Honorable Mulala said, you'll still be open about it. Is the market share that we have in the country allowing us, as I say, not just to go along, allowing us to do that with the experience we have of those that collapse as you try to put them in? If you can use the minute you have time.
Look, it's important we don't want the smaller operators to go under. If Cell C were to disappear out of the market, Telkom Mobile to disappear out of the market, that's a problem for the market. And it's a problem for consumer choice, and it's a problem for the development of the sector as a whole. So I don't know whether that's answering your question. You know, my approach to so many of these things is listen to the issues, listen to the evidence, and then carefully make up your mind as to what you're going to do. But be aware of, and it hasn't come up in the discussion here, that often a regulatory intervention creates a perverse incentive. You do something, somebody, as we've seen in so many other areas of this country, somebody's sitting there saying, how can I make money out of this? You create this fund, how can I steal from the fund? What can I do to enrich myself or benefit my company? And as regulators, we need to look at those issues. What is it that, how are people going to respond to what we do as regulators in a way that undermines what we're trying to achieve by the regulation? It's a complex set of issues that requires careful analysis, careful thought, and then, yes, we have to act.
Thank you, honorable members. I think in terms of the time allocated, we have afforded members an opportunity to interact with yourself. And I'm sure further communication will be done to our with regard to whatever needs to be sorted out with yourself. Otherwise, from the side of the subcommittee, we think it was quite an engaging comment. In a way, and a few things that I'm sure from your side you have also learned a few things. You can make a close point.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members, for some interesting questions, some difficult questions. I hope you enjoyed the interaction as much as I did. And good luck. I know you've got a long day ahead of you. Thank you.